Be turning into your Bible to Genesis 37. We're going to be there. We're going to go backwards a little bit too, but Genesis 37 is where this story of Joseph really picks up. And over the next 9 weeks, I hope that you're reading this. If you just read one chapter a day, you'll get through the story in 2 weeks. And if you do that, then you can get through the story five times while we're moving through it. That would be a good thing to do. You know, as I begin this morning, one of the things I've been thinking about this week is the misnomers that we carry about the characters in the Bible. So many people think about the characters in the Bible and in their own minds, they picture them as being perfect. You know, they're in the Bible, that's how it's got to be. If they're in the Bible, then they must have had their personal act together. They must have had perfect faith, perfect relationship with God, perfect relationship with the people on the earth. I mean, it's like they never experienced struggles or pain or hardships or disappointments. Their lives were just carefree. They lived in this bubble of God. And the reality is, if you've read the Bible, you know that that is absolutely 100% not true. Every major character in the Bible, in fact, every character in the Bible was far from perfect. Every major character in the Bible had significant issues in their life. They were dysfunctional. Dysfunctional. Say that with me. Dysfunctional. Come on, say it again. Dysfunctional. Job. I mean, we talk about Job. He had this great patience as the trials of his life mounted onto him and piled onto him as his wife was nagging him just to curse God and die, and his friends were telling him all this weird stuff. Job had this patience to persevere, but he also got to a place where he questioned God and he was demanding answers of the Creator. David had a huge heart of worship. He had a huge heart of devotion for God. He wrote a great number of the Psalms in the Old Testament, worship songs to God. But he also committed adultery. And when that was getting ready to be exposed, he followed it up with murder. Moses was the man who stood in the presence of God on Mount Sinai, spoke with God, talked with God, communicated with God like two people facing each other. But he was also a murderer, got easily angered, dealt with depression, spent time being greatly discouraged. Paul was an unbelievable evangelist and missionary, and in the process of all that, wrote half of the books of the New Testament. But he was also a zealot before he was converted to Jesus. And he was working to literally wipe out the church. I mean, literally, he was killing people against who stood against Judaism. Every one of them. I mean, if you go through and look at their lives, every one of them struggled. They all had their foibles. They all had their personal issues. They all had their problems. The story of the Bible is not that God only works with perfect people. If God only worked with perfect people, there would be nobody that he would be working with, because there are no perfect people. Amen, church? There are no perfect people. Would you say that with me? There are no perfect people. Turn to the person next to you and say, I really believe he's talking to you. Go ahead, tell him, all right? There are no perfect people. The story of the Bible is that God comes into imperfect people's lives and helps them overcome their issues, their stuff, their past, their dysfunction. God is able to take our past, clean it up, make us new, and then use us to accomplish great things for his kingdom. And there is no greater example of that truth in the Bible than the person we're digging into study about. His name was Joseph. Several things I want you to hear as we start thinking about dysfunction this morning. And the first one is this, that there is a long history. Dysfunction ran amok in the family of Abraham. I'm sure you've heard the old saying, we're all a product of our environment. It's true. Typically, the way that we think, the way that we act, the way that we believe, the way that we speak, the way that we respond, the political party we belong to, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Typically, those things are influenced by the people and things around us. It's just true. The apple does not fall far from the tree. Typically, you can look at a problem in somebody's life, and then you can trace that problem backwards. When I started working as in my graduate degree, for my graduate degree, it was in counseling. And listen, as a counselor, I learned this truth. I'm telling you, behavior begets behavior. When parents live, think, act, respond in certain ways, it typically gets passed on to their kids. Their kids grow up. They follow suit. They do the same things. Not always, but it's not seldom either. I mean, we are all products of our environment. What one generation does is typically passed on to the next generation. Parents, like it or not, you are influencing your kids for good, for bad. Whenever my kids did something really off the wall, really awful, you know, when they were little growing up and they would do something, I would look at Brenda and I would say, "Where in the world did they learn that?" And she would just smirk at me and say, like, duh, like from us. That's where they got it. And she was right. Behavior begets behavior. It passes itself on. When I was 2 years old, there's a story that runs through our family. I was 2 years old. And my mom, who was very young, my mom was married at 19, pregnant at 19. I was born when she was 20. So here, my mom's 22 years old. She's got this, and by the way, I was a gorgeous little baby. You know what I mean? So my mom had invited all of her friends over to see, you know, this gorgeous two-year-old. And so all the friends came over, and they're all happy, and they're all excited. And I was back in the room, and I was playing. And so when they all got there, they said, we want to see him. Because I don't know if you knew this or not, I was a gorgeous little kid, right? So all my mom's friends are tiptoeing down the hall, and the door was cracked, and so they pushed it open a little bit. My back was turned, you know, as I'm sitting on the floor, and I was stacking blocks. And all the blocks, you know, I'm stacking them, and I kind of sing-songing to myself, and then all of the blocks fell over. And when they hit the ground, I just kind of went, humph, and then I said, "Damn blocks." A two-year-old said that. And I'm telling you, my mom was mortified. Her friends are laughing because I didn't just pick that off the television. I got it from my mom. It's true. Behavior begets itself. We all need to own this truth. When one generation lives a certain way, those behaviors are typically passed on to the next generation. And so when we get to Genesis 37 and start digging into the family of Jacob and into this one named Joseph and his 11 sons, there's a question whether Benjamin's really been born yet or not. There's arguments to be made on both sides. Eventually, there would be 12 sons of Jacob. Jacob's name is changed to Israel. These become the 12 sons of Israel, or the 12 tribes of Israel. But as we start digging in here to these 11 or 12 sons at this point, what we find is huge amounts of dysfunction. The dysfunction that exists in Jacob's family is almost impossible to imagine. But I'm here to tell you that it didn't begin in chapter 37 of Genesis. The dysfunction that exists here in Genesis 37 actually goes all the way back. It goes all the way back to grandfather Abraham. And wisdom would tell us that it was happening before Abraham, with his father Terah, and with his father before him, and with his father before him. Because dysfunction begets dysfunction. There's a long history of dysfunction in the family of Abraham. And the biblical text, bears it out. Abraham, well, there was rivalry in his house. And it led straight to jealousy and hostility. Genesis 12, Abraham's called. And the promise starts right there. You are going to be the father of a great nation. It's in chapter 15 that Abraham is really kind of down and depressed a little bit because he doesn't have any kids. He's saying to God, "What is this servant? Eliezer, the servant in my house, is he gonna be the heir?" And God's saying, No. I want you to go outside, Abraham. I want you to look up. Genesis chapter 15, verse 4 and 5. Look it up. Look at the stars in the sky, Abraham, and see if you can count them. And I'm telling you, I know they're uncountable, and as uncountable as those stars are, so are going to be the descendants that flow from you. Now, the problem is that at this point, Abraham's about 80 years of age. His wife is 70 years of age. And now another 5 years passes, and there still isn't any children. And that's when Sarah, 75 years old now, gets a great idea. His barren wife comes up with the idea that that Abraham should take Hagar. Hagar is Sarah, her handmaiden. The idea is that she will become my Sarah. Go have a sexual relationship with him. Let her become impregnated. There will be a baby that will be born, and then I will like adopt that in. That will be my son. It's what Abraham did. And in Genesis chapter 16, at the ripe old age of 86, Abraham and his concubine, Hagar, have a son. His name is Ishmael. Now, if you're familiar with the story, you know this is when trouble hit. Suddenly, there's jealousy in the house. Genesis 16:4 tells us that the minute Hagar was pregnant, suddenly she's like puffing up. She's like, look at me. And it's like, I'm the one that's carrying the child, and she's looking at her, and she's looking at the one that she serves and works for. She's saying, you're not pregnant, I'm pregnant. It's kind of like a neener, neener, neener going on. And as this is all going on, Sarah is already hurt because she doesn't have any kids, but now she's coming up with anger. She's mad, and she starts blaming Abraham. She says in chapter 16, verse 5, Sarah said, you're responsible for the wrong that I am suffering. Now, it's funny because this is all her idea. But now it's like Abraham's fault. So Abraham, not knowing what to do, he wants to please his wife. So Abraham gives his wife, Sarah, permission to do whatever she wants to do with Hagar. And that's when Sarah starts abusing Hagar. So much so that Hagar leaves. She runs away. She takes the boy. She runs away. An angel appears to the runaway servant and encourages her to go home. Says that this son, that there's going to be a nation that will come from him as well. I want you to go home. I want you to fulfill your requirements. Serve Sarah. She did. Now, the amazing thing here is that this was all Sarah's idea. But it wasn't God's idea. It wasn't God's plan. Now, it's 14 years later when Abraham's 100 and Sarah is now 90 that the tables turn. Because now Sarah, at the ripe old age of 90, is found to be pregnant. And now that the tables are turned and this son, Isaac, is born, Sarah once again turns to start abusing this slave. Genesis 21, Hagar and Ishmael are literally driven from the household and they never returned. The die of dysfunction was cast by the actions of Abraham and Sarah. They should have put all of this to an end. I mean, the minute Hagar rose up and started her thing, Sarah should have backed off and said, look, it's not how we act. Here's how we act. Here's how we respond. We love. We're going to be gracious to one another. It's the way God wants us to be. No. We're going to seek forgiveness. We're not going to be. No. They should have worked to heal over the rift that they had created, but that's not what happened. And I want you to know that none of it was God's will. A repentant heart, a change of actions would have worked wonders here, but it didn't. And as a result, Abraham had two sons, one that he held close and one that he pushed away. It was dysfunctional. And as a result, the dysfunction was passed on. Isaac, the favored son of Abraham, is now playing parental favorites. He's most certainly following his father's lead. When he was 60 years old, 60, twins are born. Their names are Esau and Jacob. Esau was the oldest, Jacob is the younger. Having twins, I can tell you that many people think that twins are like exactly alike. And that their personalities are exactly alike, and you know they think alike. And I'm just telling you that's not true. When you have twins, it's just like other kids in your house. They are two different people, two completely different people. They have different personalities, different likes, different tastes, different. Brenda and I worked hard to raise our twins that way so that there would, you know, be no favoritism passed on to either one of them. We wanted both of them to be the individual people that they were, and we wanted to love them for who they were. But that's not how Isaac and Rebecca raised their twins. Genesis 25 spells out the ugly truth. The boys grew up. Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for the wild game, loved Esau. And mom, Rebecca, she loved the other kid, Jacob. Now you talk about horrible parenting. Here it is. One verse. This is patriarchs in the Old Testament, folks. The boys grew up knowing that one of their parents preferred the other one. You have to know it led to trouble. Years later, the favoritism plays itself out fully. Genesis 27, Isaac is moving towards the end of his life. It's time now to hand out the fatherly blessing. Esau has already sold his birthright as the oldest son. He sold it for a bowl of lentil soup. And so he's not going to get this big inheritance that he's supposed to get. It's going to Jacob. But the one thing he's holding on to is the blessing. And it's the one thing he wants. Isaac says, it's time. I'm getting ready to die. It's time. And so so Esau's to get it as the oldest. Isaac calls Esau in. He says, I want you to go out into the open fields. I want you to hunt some wild game. I want you to dress it. I want you to bring it home. I want you to cook it just the way I like. We're going to enjoy this meal together. And when we're done, Esau, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put my hands on you and I'm going to give you the blessing that you're waiting for. Rebecca, mom, is sitting. She's sitting just behind the veil. She hears the whole conversation. So as soon as Esau takes off, he's going to be gone for hours, maybe a day or two, as he's taking care of this business. Rebecca grabs the son that she joyfully loves, Jacob. She says, go out to the pen, grab an animal. We got work to do. Jacob does. He grabs it. They bring it in. They hurry up. They cook it just how Isaac would want it. And she's explaining to her son what we're going to do. We're going to steal. You got the birthright. Now we're going to steal the blessing. And Jacob's saying, it'll never work. Hey, Esau's this big, hairy behemoth of a guy, and I'm kind of small and slight. Dad's never going to fall for this. The deal was Isaac was blind. Mom says, no problem. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take some of that animal skin. We'll put it on your arms, put it here on your chest, you know. And then what we're going to do is put Esau's robe on you. He will touch you. You will feel hairy. He will smell you. You will smell. So that's exactly what happened. Jacob, a few hours later, comes in with a tray of food. Jacob, Isaac's a little bit, this happened really quick, but great. So he's smelling, sounds good. So he says, come here, lean in. He touches his son. And he said, you know what? It feels like Esau. It smells like Esau, but it sounds like Jacob to me. But he goes ahead and eats, and then he pours out this blessing on the wrong son. Genesis 27:41. Says that Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother. How would you respond if you had a ravenous mountain man coming to take you out? Well, Jacob did the smart thing. He ran for his life. And as this dysfunction continues to play itself out, what you need to know is it didn't stop here. It moved on. It moved on into other parts of the family. And that's where we move next, to Laban, who was a con artist. Laban was Jacob's mother's, Rebekah's, was her brother. The family tree looks something like this. Terah, we learn about in Genesis chapter 11, had three sons, Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Now, these three sons of Terah had sons. We don't know all of their kids' names, but we know some of them. Haran had Lot. When Abraham left for the promised land, he took Lot with him. Lot, think of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Lot came with Uncle Abraham on that journey. Nahor had Bethuel as a son, and then Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. We already know that Ishmael was the one that was pushed out. Now Bethuel has two kids. He has a daughter named Rebekah, and he has a son named Laban. And Isaac and Rebekah marry each other, and they have two sons, twins, Esau and Jacob. And now Laban is going to have two kids that we're going to learn about here. One of them is named Leah, and one of them is Rachel. So this was Uncle Laban. This was Uncle Laban. Let's go back one slide, please. This is Uncle Laban to Jacob, his mother Rebekah, her brother. And so now that Esau has declared that he's angry and he's going to kill his brother runs. So let's go to that map now, okay? And let's push the slide ahead. I'm sorry, it's my fault. There we go. So he's going to run. He starts kind of at that bottom left circle. This is Shechem, Jerusalem, Jericho. You can maybe see in the circle. And then he's going to run. He's going to run north, and then he's going to come over the top of the Fertile Crescent into Paddan Aram. It's like a 375-mile trip, give or take. And what Jacob is hoping is that this distance, the distance, is going to keep him safe from the threat of his brother. So Laban had two daughters, Leah and Rachel. And in Genesis 29, Jacob immediately, when he arrives, he takes notice of the younger daughter. Laban wanted to pay his nephew for working for him. You know, you're here, you're going to take part of the family. I got to pay you. What do you want me to pay you? Jacob comes up with a great idea. He's looking at the younger daughter and he's saying about Rachel, you know what, I'd like your younger daughter, Rachel, to be my wife. And so here's what I'm willing to do. I'll give you 7 years of my life to work for her. That's what I'll do. So that's exactly what happened. For 7 years, Jacob toils away to get Rachel to be his wife. When the 7 years are up, he goes to his uncle. He says, I've done my time. I've paid you the 7 years. I want to get married. And if you know the story, you know what happened. On the day of the wedding, Uncle Laban, good old crafty Uncle Laban, he switched the two daughters. He takes Leah and he puts Leah under the veil. So imagine Jacob's surprise when he winds up in the honeymoon suite and they're in the middle of what they're doing on their honeymoon night, right? And that he realizes that he's not looking at Rachel, he's looking at Leah. He's obviously a little bit upset. He goes to his uncle and he says, what have you done to me? What have you done? Laban just, hey man, welcome to the family, right? I mean, it's what we do. We take advantage of each other and we set each other up. So here's what he says. He says, let's go back one slide. He says, finish this daughter's bridal week, finish it. Then I'll give you the younger daughter also in return for another 7 years. Now, what I want you to read here is he didn't have to wait 7 years to get Rachel. He had his bridal week with Leah. And then when that was done, he immediately got Rachel with the promise, you'll give me 7 more years. Now, if you read here, Jacob now is going to spend 7 years taking advantage of his uncle. He's going to kind of take all of his herds at the end of the day. And so the bottom line is Jacob agrees. Within a week, he's married to two sisters. So the family tree looks like this. And as I think about being married to two sisters, can you maybe just begin to imagine just a little bit that there might have been just a wee little bit of tension in this house going down? Oh, the happy ties of a dysfunctional family, right? The family of Abraham is full of this stuff. And as a result, Jacob, who is going to be named Israel, renamed Israel, follows suit. He follows right in the family footsteps. It shouldn't be surprising. He was doing what he had been taught to do. He was trained in dysfunction. He lived it out. And that brings us to Genesis 37. And more brings us to Joseph. Joseph, the innocent one, the innocent recipient of all of this jealousy and hate that's been going on for 168 years. When Joseph was born, all attention was thrown his way. Here's what Genesis 37:3 says. It's all laid out in just 11 simple words. Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Where did that come from? Well, it came from Abraham, his grandfather, and it came from Isaac, his dad. It raises the important question, why? Why would Jacob play favorites? Well, what was the justification for this horrific action? Well, the Bible actually lays out two reasons. First, Joseph was born to Jacob in his old age. That's how verse 3 of chapter 37 continues. Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. Jacob was 91 years old when Joseph was born. And this father doted on this son born in his senior advanced years. But there was a bigger reason. And the bigger reason was that Joseph was the first son of his favorite wife. Now, sometime this week, I want to encourage you to go back to chapter 29 and 30 of Genesis and read what's happening. But in a graphic form, it looks like this. Jacob married sisters, and so he has two wives. One of them's named Leah. One of them is named Rachel. And now that they're married, Leah starts popping out babies. In fact, she very quickly has four sons. Simeon, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Now, if you know the 12 tribes of Israel, this is all going to make sense because these are them. These sons are going to become the tribes. So while Leah is popping out sons, Rachel is barren. And as you might imagine, that's a little bit painful. So she does what Grandma Sarah did, and that's she takes her maidservant and she gives her maidservant, which is named Bilhah, and she gives Bilhah to her husband to raise kids in her stead. And so two kids are born, Dan and Naphtali. By this time, Leah's not having babies, and so she gives her maidservant to Jacob to raise up kids, and Gad and Asher are born. Man, Jacob's like going, you know, a lot to keep up with here, but, you know, I'm willing to try. And so now it goes on. At this point, Leah's womb opens up. She has a couple of more kids. Their names are going to be Issachar and Zebulun. So you can imagine the amount of years that are going by here, still no son for Rachel. And then, with 10 sons born, suddenly Rachel is found to be pregnant. And the son who's born has a name. His name is Joseph. Now in Hebrew, we would say Yosef. Yosef. So what does the name mean? Let me tell you. When you see a yud, a y, what the Hebrews automatically sometimes did is shorten the name of God. Yahweh would be the name of God in the Old Testament. We would say Jehovah, Jehovah in English, but in Hebrew you would say Yahweh. And those two first letters, Y and an A, would sometimes be shortened down to be the representation of God's name. So Y-O or Y-A-Yo is speaking of God. His name is God, and then Seth, you add to the end. Seth means given or added. In other words, Yosef's name is Yahweh added. Yahweh gave. This son is the gift of God. More than any of the other previous 10 sons, this son is the favored son. He's the son that was given to us by God. Jacob has 10 other sons. None of them have a name like this. But they gave this son to the favorite wife this name. Joseph was the treasured favorite son of Jacob's favorite wife. He was a gift to Rachel by God himself. And everybody else in the family, especially the 10 other brothers, had to live under the roof with knowledge of that. He was special and wanted. They weren't. Do you think there might have been just a little bit of jealousy or tension or hostility running among the 10 older brothers and Leah concerning all of this? And then Jacob took a couple of more steps to pour gas onto the fire. The favorite son received a special coat. Verse 3 goes on, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe. Now, you've probably heard the words richly ornamented, or maybe you've heard the phrase a coat of many colors. Actually, neither of those two phrases really give justice to what the Hebrew says here. The Hebrew basically is speaking, though, of a full-length coat. Think of a broad coat with long sleeves that would flow all the way to the wrist and maybe down covering part of the hands. This was the kind of robe, the kind of coat, a kind of robe that a king would wear, the kind of robe that a nobleman would wear, the kind of robe that a very wealthy man would wear. And it's not the robe that a shepherd would keep out in the fields. This is a family of shepherds. These guys are going to have something that's a little bit more ragtag to run around in, not Joseph. Joseph has a coat that is befitting of a king that has been given to him by his father, and none of the other brothers had one. So what was the response of the brothers to this favoritism? Verse 4 says, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him. Hate. In fact, they couldn't say one kind thing about him. The only thing Joseph heard from his brothers was venom. Are you surprised? And then Jacob took the next horrible step. Jacob used Joseph as a tattletale. In chapter 37, verse 2, the chapter opens up with Joseph coming home, the youngest son coming home from the fields, and he's bringing his father a bad report about what's going on out there. You know what the other 10 sons are doing, father? And he brings his report to tattle on his brothers. Now you have to think very quickly that the brothers are not going to like what this little tattletale is doing. And because of that, there's fear here. Fear on the father's behalf that there's a potential harassment, or that the kid's going to get beat up, or his life is going to be made miserable. So at this point, what Jacob does is responds, not by saying, Joseph, don't do that anymore. You know, go out there and deal with it and work with your brothers and work out the problems out there. No, the way that he works it is he brings his kid home. And so now the kid does not have to take part in the family work to keep all the sheep. Joseph's home. And then if that's not enough, Jacob is now sending Joseph out to find out wherever his brothers are so he can make, you know, checkups on them on an ongoing basis and bring the report back to dad. Joseph has become a spy on his father's behalf. And I'm just telling you, none of it was good. And what you have to know is it sealed the deal with the brothers. But there was one more thing in the midst of this in chapter 37 that was going down, and that was the dreams. Verses 5 through 11 of chapter 37, Joseph had dreams of his brothers bowing down to him. There were sheaves of grain, and they were all, and then he's a sheaf of grain in the dream, and then all these 11 sheaves gather around him, and they're bowing down to him. And then the next dream is out in the heavens where the stars and the sun and the moon are all bowing down to him as well. Joseph's big mistake here is that he goes running to the family members to tell them about the great dreams he had, because he's interpreting, saying, y'all are going to bow down to me. And I mean, what it did, verse 8 of Genesis 37 says, they hated him all the more because of his dreams. And as he's telling his father, even his father's had enough right now. His father's rebuking him. You think I'm bowing to you, pal? You got another thing coming. I mean, it was like the teenager had grown way too big for his britches. And I'm just telling you, friends, at this point, the family is a powder keg ready to explode. There's nothing at this point that's holding back the hate. Parents, you want to wreak havoc in your family? You want to wreck your kids' relationship with each other? Then play favorites. Regard one child over another. Have deference for one child. Lift one up, put the others down. Gift one and don't gift the others. The 10 older brothers of Joseph lived with daily knowledge that they didn't measure up, that they were not the apple of their father's eye, and it brought great pain. And that pain was the cause of them lashing out against their younger brother. We'll get to that next week. For now, the pain brings us to this third idea. And that's simply, how do you put an end to dysfunction? And the truth is, this should be the goal of every one of us. We should desire, every one of us, desire and work to make our families as healthy as possible. And if the word healthy is going to be used to define your family, the relationships that you have with your parents, with your spouse, with your siblings, with your kids, then you need to work diligently to make it happen. And that work is made more difficult because the truth is we're all sinners. We're all far from perfect. But our personal sinfulness or our personal brokenness should never be an excuse for living out a dysfunctional relationship. The truth is, our families can be healthy. But to make them that way, you will have to take responsibility. And the big word here is me. I am responsible. I am responsible to push dysfunction out. I am responsible for health to be able to move in. Healthy relationships begin with each and every one of us. You can't put it off on someone else. You have to make a determination that you will be healthy. And to do that, I would encourage you to think through and to take a couple of steps. Would you write them down first? If you're going to be healthy, you have to have a clear understanding of exactly where you are unhealthy. The truth is, every one of us carries baggage. I've got it. You've got it. My wife's got it. Our kids have it. We all have it. We've all got things in our past that we're dragging around, stuff that drags us down, stuff that makes us unhealthy. My question is, do you know what that is? Do you know where you leak? Do you know what pulls you down? What are the things in your life that are damaging other people? That addiction or that anger, that low self-esteem, that jealousy, pride, stubbornness. Where is it that Satan has a hook in you and he's causing wedges to be driven with other people around you? What are the areas? Until you know what those things are, you will never face them. Putting an end to dysfunction begins with understanding and knowing where the dysfunction lies. And it lies in a different place for all of us. If you don't know, then I would suggest you ask the people that are really closest to you. Ask a sibling. Ask your parent. Ask your kids. What are the areas of my life that you find damaging to you? What are the places that when we get to that, you duck and cover because you know what's coming? It may be hard for you because it may be that this is hereditary. It's been passed on from generation to generation in your family. And I'm just telling you, when stuff gets passed on like this, it just feels normal. You've all looked at families that are going crazy and you're going, how can they deal with that? Because the craziness seems normal. That's why when you look at statistics, divorce begets divorce and abuse begets abuse. And the stuff just goes on because it's what I learned and it's what seems normal. But here's the deal. There's nothing normal about dysfunction. It's only destructive. So make every effort to claim the difficult truth In this area or in these areas. I struggle, I hurt, I have dysfunction. And I'm not only hurting myself, I'm actually hurting the people I love. So write the areas down and then make a simple decision. And the simple decision is this: it ends here, it ends now, it ends with me. So many people at this point say, you know what, yeah, I'm this way, but it's kind of just the way that I am because it's the way I was raised or the way I was taught. And so what you just need to do is deal with it. And I'm just telling you that that's a lie straight out of the pit of hell. God did not create you to be dysfunctional. So don't listen to that lie. If you're hurting other people, then be the one to stop. It ends here, it ends now, it ends with me. You know what? I love my mom and my dad. I love my grandma and my grandpa, but there were things in this family that have not been healthy, and I'm not going to carry them on to my kids and my grandkids. It ends. If it's hereditary, stop it. You be the one to say no more, no further. Is it hard? The answer is yes. So what? Be the person. So have a clear understanding of exactly where you struggle, where you're unhealthy, and then make a decision that it ends here, it ends now with me, and then take a simple step of faith and trust. Put your trust in God, because here's the deal. God will give you the strength that you need to change. You may feel powerless against the dysfunction in your life, but you're not. God doesn't call you to action without supplying you with the resource to be the person that he's called you to be. So trust God for the strength to change. One of my wife's favorite verses of scripture comes right out of Philippians chapter 4:19. Here's what it says. In fact, I want you to read it with me. Will you do that? Philippians 4:19 says, and my God will meet. Oh, I want you to read it with me. It says, and my God will meet all your needs according to his glorious riches in Christ Jesus. If God is asking you to step, if he's asking you to move, he will give you everything you need to do exactly what he's asking you to do. Psalm chapter 51, verse 10 says, create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a steadfast spirit within me. Again, my wife was reading something or listening to something. She shared this with me the other day. And it's so true. This word, create, Psalm 51, this is the exact same word in Hebrew, bara, which we found in Genesis chapter 1. Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. Bara. And what's being said here is the exact same word, Lord, create. And what Brenda was saying to me, which is so true, you know, we go and say, Lord, create in me a clean heart, which we take to mean, I got to do all the work. So you know what? Give me the strength to move forward to do it. No, what David is praying here is, Lord, this is impossible outside of me. Will you create in me a new heart? You make it. You who spoke the heavens into existence, will you do it? And the promise of the Old Testament is God will do exactly that. Ezekiel 36 says that God will come to you, remove your heart of stone. He will give you a heart of flesh. God will do the work. Do we have a great God, church? The answer is yes. He gives you the strength you need to do everything he's asked you to do. You can change. It's the miracle that he performs. So trust him for it. Trust him. And then take a fourth step. Where it's necessary, be quick, not slow, be quick to repent and seek forgiveness. So many of us are carrying this stuff around and we're waiting for all the other people in our lives to take responsibility and come here and deal with it. And here's the truth of the Bible. God never put the responsibility on somebody else. He puts the responsibility clearly on your shoulders to fix whatever's broken. In Matthew chapter 5, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, if you are there offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, in other words, you've done something to them, what Jesus says is, get up, leave the altar, leave the gift, go and be reconciled to your brother. If you have sinned against somebody, don't wait one day, don't let the sun go down on it. If you find yourself at the altar, go. Be reconciled. Matthew chapter 18, Peter's saying, how many times should I forgive my brother if he sins against me? What if it's him that did it to me? How many times should I forgive it? Should I forgive him seven times? And Jesus looks in Matthew 18, he goes, no, not seven times. He says 77 times. And really what this means in the Greek is not 77, but 70 times seven or 490. And the point is there should never be a point. I mean, it's not like I can say to my brother, that's one. That's 489. You got one more, pal, then I can pop you, right? No, it should be an uncountable number. Be quick to end the dysfunction. Claim the responsibility. If you've done it, go. If somebody else has done it, go. Go. If your relationship with others is broken, you be quick to be the one to go and deal with it. And then fifth, release all bitterness. So many of us are carrying around baggage about stuff that happened 30 years ago. It's never been dealt with. It's never been forgiven. It's never been talked through. And now I'm just bitter about it. That person walks into the room. It may have happened when you were 8 years old, and that person walks into the room and you're going, right? Release it. I was wronged. We wear it like a badge. It doesn't need to be worn. Put it away. Forgive it. Do your best to deal with it. Romans chapter 12, verse 17, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all men. Put it away. Forgive what's been done to you. Refuse to carry on the bitterness. And then one last thing. Remember, the healing often takes time. What was broken is not going to be put back together in 10 minutes. If it's been broken for 35 years, it's not 10 years in the fixing or 10 minutes in the fixing. Sometimes it's going to take time to mend trust back and to mend relationship back. Doesn't mean we shouldn't start, because every day we don't start is more time added to the end result. So if somebody needs to go a little bit slow or somebody needs to kind of weigh through some stuff, in the process, though, you can be the catalyst. Allow God to work in your life. Allow your love, your heart, your forgiveness, your grace to flourish. Allow the kind, graceful character of God to be who you are and who you are becoming. Let those characteristics determine how you're going to respond. Don't hinder the process by your actions and reaction. Be the catalyst. Give the others in your life the time they need. And it leads to one last thought, friends. It's going to be the overriding thought of the story, and that's that our amazing God is bigger than all of our broken relationships. Some people are so weighed down with the past, they can't see tomorrow. They can't see the future. All of their vision is here. And what needs to happen is this needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be put away if we're going to be people that are going to turn and move forwards. a few things to note. God is able to use even the worst of circumstances in our life. And that truth is going to scream out. You think your past is hindering you, and you hold it like that? You're right, it is. It's hindering you. God is bigger than all of this. And what God is able to do is take your worst moment, your worst sin, your worst issue, your worst stuff, and he's able to move it into something that is big and beautiful and powerful. This dysfunction had been going on in Abraham's life for 168 years, and it's going to come into Joseph, and it's going to wreak havoc on him. He's going to get sold by these angry brothers. They decide not to murder him. They decide to sell him. They sell him to the Midianites, who then sells him to Potiphar down in Egypt. He's going to spend the next 13 years of his life either as a slave or in prison. But God was bigger than all of it. And God's going to use this sin and this struggle and this pain and this hardship, and he's going to use it in an amazing way. And I want to encourage you to know that it's true. Write two passages down. I don't think they're in your notes, but write them down. Ephesians 3, 20 and 21. And really, friends, you ought to memorize this passage this week, because it's one of the great promises in the Bible. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us. Do you hear that? It's not my power, it's his power. It's at work, and he's able to do immeasurably more. I think that I'm weighed down, I'm nailed down, I'm damaged, I can never go anywhere, and this dysfunction is what it is. And I'm telling you, false. God is able to do immeasurably more than anything I could even ask or imagine, according to his power that has worked within us, me. And how about Romans 8:28? We know that in all things, God works together for the good of him who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. There is nothing too big for God. There's nothing too big for God. And because of that, you need to take all of this stuff and hand it over to him. And the point of handing it over to him is trust. I trust him. I give it to him. And I'm going to allow him to change me. Here it is, Lord. Take it. I trust you. Take it. Take it. And do your work in me, so I can be the person that you want me to be. You want to know the story of Joseph? That's it. That's it. Horrible things are done. He gave it to God. He trusted God. He allowed God to change him. And years later, when he has the 22 years later, he has the opportunity and the position to have his brothers killed. And he refrains, because he sees the hand of God. Bow your heads. Would you do that? Bow your heads. And let me just ask you, where are you today? What is it that you're struggling with? What is it that is painful to you? What is it that you are hurting over? What is it that has its arms around you? What is it that needs to be forgiven? What is it that needs to be released? What's the dysfunction in your life? Are you ready to be done with it? Hand it over to God. Put your trust in him. Follow his path. Allow yourself to be free. And Father, for so many of us, this is a difficult moment, because that stuff has been a part of us for a long time. But I pray that you would, right now, right this moment, do your work among us. Have your way. Father, create in me, bara, create in me a clean heart. Father, would you renew a steadfast spirit within me? Father, I'm going to trust you for the resource. I'm going to trust you for the strength. I'm going to trust you for the grace. I'm simply going to be obedient to you. Help me. help us. And we lift it up in the name of the one who makes it possible. His name is Jesus. And God's people said, amen.